The Authentic Success Podcast is brought to you by The Natural Professional, dedicated to supporting you in kicking ass without kicking your own ass. At naturalprofessional.com, get inspiration, tools, and skills through group and one-on-one coaching, courses, articles, video tutorials, and more. I'm Sean Tuttle, chief latte drinker here at thenaturalprofessional.com. In this episode, I'm talking with Kelly McGonigal, health psychologist and lecturer at Stanford University, and a leading expert on the mind-body relationship. One of the many awesome things you'll hear in this interview is how compassion plays a huge role in success as a business owner, from successful negotiations to your ability to rebound after a setback. Today, I'm talking with Kelly McGonigal at the Wisdom 2.0 conference, and I very much enjoyed hearing you talk with Jack Kornfield on stage yesterday with your sister, your twin sister.
Thank you.
As far as I can tell, you must be completely working your butt off. Okay, so here's what I've found, and you can tell me if I'm leaving anything out. You teach at Stanford, both undergrad and I've also heard of community education, different programs. You're involved with CCAR, the Center for Compassion and Altruism Research and Education. You're involved in developing Stanford's Center for Compassion and Altruism, and now the teacher training program for that. You teach yoga.
Yes.
And you're one of the teachers for teacher training.
Yes.
Also through the yoga studio. You're editor-in-chief at the International Journal of Yoga Therapy. You blog for Psychology Today and Mindful.org. And you collaborate with your sister on game design for kind of personal wellness type of area. And you just wrote a book.
Yes.
Yeah. How do you sleep? I mean, do you sleep?
Sleep was actually my New Year's resolution this year. And since I've been going around talking about a book on willpower, it's actually been very motivating to make sure that I'm getting sufficient and consistent sleep. When I was writing my last book, I was sleeping between about 6 a.m. and 11 a.m. every day, which was helpful time, but not sustainable. Yeah. I do work a lot, but it's because when it comes to making a choice, do I want to work on this project right now or do something else? It almost always feels like the thing that's going to be more interesting and meaningful is to do some work on the project. Mm-hmm. And one of the great things about being involved in so many different projects is that you can always choose something that allows you to access a different part of yourself, a different skill set, give you a different experience. And so they end up supporting each other.
Oh, interesting. Okay, okay.
Like sometimes you want to be alone and think, and sometimes you want to be with people, and sometimes you want to be on stage, and sometimes you want to have a private conversation.
Right, right. And they're all in the same general arena of mindfulness, yoga, and I would guess very much... That's what I'm looking for. So this is an area that I've been working on developing for the natural professional. I haven't come up with the language for it yet, so I'm hoping in talking with people it'll come up. Having to do with the experience. So not as much the what you're doing as much as how you feel and who you are in doing it. So is that what you mean when you're talking about it? There's different avenues that you can follow, maybe writing or being with people. Yeah.
Yes, and I mean, I pick my projects based on whether the process is something that I enjoy rather than wanting an outcome. Like, I want a book in the bookstores or on Amazon. That would not make it worth writing a book. There has to be something intrinsically rewarding about the process of doing it. And same thing with teaching and with everything else that I do. I'm never thinking this is going to look a certain way on my resume. Or, at the end of the day when I have something in my hand, that's going to be the moment when it's going to be really satisfying. It has to be the process and the experience.
Nice. Okay. Love it. Do you think of it with that vocabulary, process and experience, or do you have another name for it?
Yeah, no, I do. I mean, I guess that is the way that I think about it, process. I mean, when I think, I'm thinking right now about my next book project, and what I'm thinking is, how much fun it's going to be to go through the scientific literature on this topic that I haven't really explored in depth in a couple of years since the last time I taught a class on it. The topic is the science of stress. And I just thought how much fun it's going to be to spend a few months reading everything that has come out since the last time that I've looked at this topic and talking to the scientists. Like that struggle to figure out how it all comes together. That's why I want to write another book as opposed to, you know, sort of the outcome.
Right. Do you run across any challenges around that? Being at Stanford, from what I hear, there's a lot of pressure to publish. But it sounds like you like to write, so that's cool, and do the research.
Yeah.
But
so I left the whole tenure track. In fact, I used to have a full-time faculty position, and I even left that 3 years ago.
Okay.
One of the things that I found in carving out my path is whenever I've tried to put myself on a traditional path, I instantly feel trapped when people expect you to... everything has to happen in a certain way, and it's very linear, and we've chosen the steps for you, and these are the hoops you need to jump through. And if you aren't this way, it's not going to be, you know, you're not going to be the right kind of person, which sort of describes graduate school and academia. One of the best things that I've learned to do is trust that who I am is somebody who's always going to be a little bit on the edges and bringing together different worlds. So that when, you know, when I'm in the yoga community, I'm scientist Kelly. When I'm in the science community, I'm mindful Kelly. And that I'm never sort of the prototype in any given field, the exemplar of what it means to be a great academic. I'm always going to be the person who's on the fringe of the academics trying to speak to the public, for example. And when I'm speaking to the public, I'm going to be the weirdo pulling out the data panels and the images of the brain. And so it was important to learn to trust that it was okay to be that person rather than to follow the expectations that most people have for how things should go.
Oh, nice. Love it. So you're very entrepreneurial, even though you're playing in, you know, kind of on the edge of the academic community. But it sounds like you've found the vehicle, the right vehicle that allows you to move forward with your passion, which I want to come. Let's come to the beginning.
Okay.
So all of these things that, you know, are around the mindful and experience. So where is that from? How did you come to that? So I will have show notes, and so I'll be linking to your website and some of your articles and stuff through that.
So as you heard me say yesterday, the way that I came to mindfulness and to yoga and to these practices was through my own suffering, both physical and psychological. I have experienced chronic pain since I was a kid. And I actually started meditating when I was a kid. And I sort of took to it very instinctively. It's been mindfulness and yoga over the years that have helped me deal with chronic pain and actually reduce the pain to the point where, like, so right now I'm in pain. But it's not, like, you probably can't tell. And it's not interfering with my ability to be present and to engage with life. In many ways, I was drawn to practice just to look for some set of skills or strategies that would help me be present with something I couldn't get rid of or fix. And then when I arrived at graduate school, and the ordinary stresses, there's nothing extraordinary about the stress of graduate school, except that it is sort of uniformly difficult. I think my sister called it soul-crushing yesterday.
Yeah, right.
And they don't mean to, but it just kind of is. That was when I started to really devote myself to practice and to find local teachers. And at that point in my life, it was about overcoming this feeling of social isolation. You know, I had picked up from the East Coast, moved to Stanford, didn't know anyone, was used to living in an urban setting where the possibilities for human interaction are endless. You know, you would meet a new person every day on the street. You could talk to a cab driver. Here at Stanford, I felt so isolated. If you walk on the street, you're the only one walking because everyone else is in their cars. And people, it felt to me that people were much more sort of in these established social networks that I didn't know how to break into. And so practice actually allowed me to find communities that I could become involved in. And that's actually when I started teaching too. And finding that the role of teaching yoga actually gave me a way to connect with people in an environment where I felt like all of my old strategies for forming social networks weren't working. And so that's how I came to bridge what I was doing as a scientist in the psychology department in the School of Medicine with things like yoga and meditation. And then once I was doing both, it just became natural to think, well, let's study scientifically what this meditation is doing. And that's how I ended up involved with CCARE, the Center for Compassion and Altruism, where we're studying if people engage in these meditation practices and these ideas, how does it influence depression, anxiety, social relationships, physical health?
Oh, that's excellent. Did you help get that program going?
I didn't start the institute. So we're an interdisciplinary institute. A lot of funders came forward from Silicon Valley, met with His Holiness the Dalai Lama, and so the center emerged that would bring together all sorts of disciplines at Stanford. They brought me on early on to help develop the compassion cultivation training. And so along with a few other scientists and Thupten Jinpa, who's the senior translator for the Dalai Lama, we created this 9-week course that bridges psychology, neuroscience, and meditation practices to help people cultivate compassion for themselves and for others. Mm. So I've been teaching that for about 3 years, and we've been studying it scientifically. Our first results are under review, so they'll be out, fingers crossed, sometime soon. But we found really great results, and now we're launching a teacher training program for professionals in any field, law, medicine, business, you name it, who want to figure out how to bring compassion and self-compassion into their workplace and share it with others.
Mm, that's awesome. So I want to come back to this, you know, awareness of you being a pioneer in your field. I listened to the interview that you did with Buddhist Geeks, and I remember you saying that when you got to Stanford...
Yeah, they made fun of me.
Yeah, like practically poo-pooing mindfulness. It's like, yeah. Oh, yeah, that stuff there.
And the weird stuff.
The weird stuff.
And now it's actually like one of the core research projects of the lab that that I did my PhD in. It's fantastic, but you know, even more fantastic, I have to say, that the culture of that lab has changed since they began studying mindfulness and compassion, to the point where now graduate students who work in that lab are having some of the best and most supportive experiences of students that I know. And so it's this little microcosm that shows how when you begin to explore these ideas and practices, it can transform the culture of the workplace. And so now, I used to advise a lot of graduate students who were always suffering, and now it's the people who are in this lab who feel like they can sort of talk more honestly about their experiences and be supported in their individual paths.
It seems like that might get at the heart of how people learn. So someone can take a class and they take in the information and they listen and maybe they go and try it at home or something like that. But by being engaged, by supporting each other, by really studying it and maybe even teaching, being in teaching roles with each other, they really start to embody it.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think that being in relationship with someone who is really conscious about this stuff is probably the most effective way that people learn it. You know, you can show up to a class and hear someone talk about compassion or talk about living your values. You can read books about it, read the scientific papers about how great it is. But I think it's when you're interacting with someone who is really trying to come from that place and that intention that you realize the experience you're having is profoundly different than the typical experience, that people are actually paying attention to you, they're actually listening, that they don't seem to be as reactive to every stressor. And in my experience, people, when they see that that's possible, that's when they really want to do it.
Oh.
And so I always think of, you know, the students who take the compassion class, obviously we as the teachers are trying to model that, but I think about them themselves and the transformation they go through in that classroom, that it's like we're sprinkling these little seeds of compassion into all different communities and workplaces and families because they change. And then, you know, their friends and their family and their colleagues may not need to come take a compassion class because one of the most important things that we talk about is the transactional nature of personality. That when I look at you and I see the best version of you, you are more likely to be that version of yourself. And if I look at you and I have assumptions about negative motivations you might have or secret agendas and I'm projecting that onto you, you're going to react to that in a way that you're more like that version of yourself. And so one of the most important things we're doing with the compassion training is helping people choose to look at others and see the best aspects of themselves. And this is something that, whether you're a teacher or whether you're, you know, a leader, a manager, that when you have that skill, it can radically transform a culture or a relationship. One of my favorite studies that I often use when I'm first trying to persuade people that compassion is worth cultivating. So a lot of times I hear, well, compassion is great like for your kid or for a puppy, or maybe if you're a nurse. But in the real world, compassion will get you killed. And so there's this great study that showed people coming into a business negotiation, and they measured the attitudes that each person in the negotiation had about the other, whether they were suspicious of their motives, whether they felt compassion for that person's needs in the situation. And the more compassion that each party felt for the other, not only the better the ultimate outcome, so if you look at joint gains, there were more joint gains where both people benefited from some decision, but that individual person's gains were also larger. Mm. That you get more personal benefit from a negotiation, you get more wins from a negotiation when you have compassion for your partner in that negotiation. And that was true both for people who were in power and for the people who had less power. It's not about, you know, only it's only important for the person who's really in charge. It was on both sides. And I feel like that's counter to most people's intuition, right, where we feel like we have to come in really on guard so that we don't
give anything away. Yeah. Well, it seems like it takes the focus away from the short-term gain, like what do I need from this, or what do I have to gain, or what's my bottom line, to kind of a higher good. And if compassion in, you know, a win-win situation is mm-hmm. the general umbrella mm-hmm. coming into it.
Because when we hear win-win, I think what we actually think we're hearing is, that means I'm going to lose.
Oh.
You know, it's like we hear win-win and it seems to us like, well, that means I'm giving away part of my win so someone else can win. And what this particular study was showing is that actually there was more win-win and there was more personal win. There was mm-hmm. actually more good created because people care about things differently. So, you know, this particular study was looking at hiring decisions and things like start dates and salaries and benefits. And it turns out that, you know, an employer may have different priorities than the employee.
Sure.
And being able to listen to each other helped people figure out how they could really get what they wanted and also give what the other person wanted.
Oh, awesome. Mm-hmm. Taking this in a slightly different direction, one of the things that you mentioned yesterday about your current passion is self-compassion.
Yeah.
So I was wondering if you would talk a little bit more about that. Most of us are so hard on ourselves, and we have such high expectations, and when we don't meet up with them, are the first ones to say, oh, I'm such an idiot, I can't believe I did that. I think that in general, people don't realize how detrimental that is, and they also don't know what to do about it.
Yeah. Well, so we should probably start by defining compassion, which
okay.
we haven't done. And compassion is a response to suffering. And it's a response to suffering in which you are aware that suffering is present. You feel a natural connection and warmth for the person who's suffering, which leads to a desire to relieve that suffering. Mm. So self-compassion means when you have a setback, you know, when you make a mistake, when you're under stress, your first instinct isn't self-criticism. Oh, you know, I'm such a stupid person. Why did I do that again? I'm hopeless, blah, blah, blah. That you actually see that you're suffering in that situation, to be aware that you're disappointed, to be aware that you tried your best and it didn't work, and that there may be some sadness or some frustration present. And to be able to see all of the emotions and the thoughts and the beliefs that are present as a kind of suffering that proves you're human, not as evidence that you are fundamentally broken, which is what we tend to do. We take that setback and we think it says something about what's wrong with us.
Right.
And one of the other elements of self-compassion is to be able to see our own suffering and our setbacks as what connects us to others rather than what isolates us from others, to take an expansive mm-hmm. view. So, you know, if I make a decision that ends up turning out to be a really bad decision, negative consequences, I might think, that's right, you know, this is who I am. I'm someone who makes stupid mistakes. Everyone else is smarter than me or luckier than me. And the self-compassionate point of view is to think everyone makes mistakes. And it's amazing how hard it is for most people to expand out to that view of common humanity
right.
when we're spiraling down into self-criticism and shame. And it turns out actually that having compassion for ourselves is often more difficult for people than having compassion even for an enemy. That people will say, I can feel compassion even for, you know, and Bernie Madoff or whoever is the enemy of the day.
Right.
But then they make one tiny mistake and suddenly they, you know, are flooded with self-criticism and shame. And the science suggests that the more self-critical you are and the harder you are on yourself, the more likely you are to give up in the face of challenges, the more likely you are to let a single setback push you into maybe a total loss of control or giving up. In fact, it's the people who forgive themselves for their mistakes that are more likely to re-engage with goals after a setback. They're willing to reapproach what they really want, which is a part of self-compassion, that you say, you know what? I have a real aspiration here. I have a vision. And this setback, which might push me towards giving up, the compassionate thing to do is to re-engage with that vision and with that aspiration. That's a big part of self-compassion. And again, the more critical you are, the harder it is to do that, because then we have all these emotions we need to escape. It's like if you know that you're going to be anxious and full of self-hate and self-doubt and despair every time you make a mistake, you're going to start to protect yourself and not go after the things that you really want and that are really meaningful to you.
And we end up playing small.
Yeah.
And not reaching for our potential.
And we control the things we think we can control. And we let our lives get smaller and more narrowly defined by the things that, you know, we don't have to be terrified that we're going to fail.
So I don't know if this is completely on topic with that, but in workshops that I've done with people, my observation is that some people get more or less addicted to that response of self-flagellation.
Mm.
You know, they're just in that groove.
You know what? So in my experience, many, even very successful people, believe that self-criticism is what is holding them together. I even remember with my meditation teacher and with her talking about giving up self-hate and anxiety, I had a very strong belief that if I gave up my anxiety, I would never do anything. Because I was so used to acting from anxiety in order to meet deadlines or be more of a perfectionist to make sure that I didn't let people down. And I thought that's what my motivation was. And I didn't know what was going to come up in the place of anxiety. And I thought I would stay in bed all day, which, you know, as you mentioned at the beginning of the
day,
not the case. And what I think people don't realize is that there is this whole other side of you that is motivated to act in line with your values, to do work that is meaningful, to collaborate with others. There's this part of you that actually is extremely motivated.
Right.
But if we're so used to driving ourselves by the threat of self-criticism or the fear of failing, we will cling to that, like you said, kind of like an addiction, because we don't trust that anything will rise up in the place of that if we let it go.
Okay, great. Oh, love this stuff. So again, in this vein of helping people understand themselves better, especially their undesirable behaviors, you recently wrote for the Psychology Today, was that in the magazine or was it on the website?
The blog.
For the blog.
Yeah.
Why stress makes it difficult to change a habit and what you
yeah.
can do about it. You know, as if we didn't know that stress isn't good for us, but you put it out in this way that was just so beautifully understandable. Undeniable and irrefutable.
Ooh, you tell me, reflect back, what did you get from it? What's your understanding?
Well, let me pull out the parts that just made me go like, okay, listeners need to hear this. Okay, so stress, so I'm reading.
Okay.
Stress selectively inhibits the circuitry of self-awareness and self-control, and it activates the circuitry of habit and impulse. Neuroscientists describe it like flicking a switch. Stress hormones turn off the reflection mode and turn on the reflex mode. So the result being when we're under stress at work or at home, we find ourselves feeling stuck and out of control. Stress even impairs our brain's ability to predict the consequences of choice.
I know, isn't that crazy?
Yes.
When I first started seeing those studies, I thought that explains so much. That when you're under stress and you do these things that you later feel so guilty and ashamed or regretful of, and you're sitting there thinking, why did I do that?
Yes.
How did I not know this was going to go wrong or I was going to regret it? And when I started seeing those studies that people literally could not predict the consequences of their behavior, I thought that that is what the experience is like. And this idea that you just described is one the thing for me that has really driven my understanding of willpower and self-control. That even though we have one brain, we have two minds. We have these competing selves, and every human being has it.
Right.
There is a version of you that is driven by certain circuitry in your brains that will push you towards every survival instinct you have, to eat when you see food, to yell or aggress when you're angry, to buy when you see something you want, to be afraid and to try to protect yourself. And you also have the circuitry in your brain that is more your sort of wise self. And it's the part of you that remembers your big goals, not your immediate temptations. It's the part of you that can make skillful and accurate predictions about what might come to be. And we alternate between having each of these circuits more dominant. And you are like a totally different person when you're acting from one versus the other. And so a lot of the work that I do now is, how do you help people move towards that wiser self when we know that stress is the number one thing that makes our brain flip into this impulsive self? Because we know we're never going to get rid of stress, right?
Right.
And nobody wants that. You do not want a life without stress. Because when people think about what creates stress in their lives, it's usually relationships that are meaningful to them. And it may be really hard. You may be a caregiver. There may be conflict in a relationship. But that doesn't mean you don't want friends and family.
Right.
Nobody wants a life without any meaningful work, even though work is full of pressure and conflict.
And growth, opportunities, yeah. And pushing past our boundaries.
So yeah. We have to find a way to stay involved with things, circumstances that are stressful, and yet still somehow change what our inner response to those circumstances.
So is that the stress physiology that you mentioned at the end of the article?
Yeah, and so anything you can do to change just the basic physiology of how your body and brain respond to stress can really help you stay in that wiser self and allow the brain systems of self-awareness and self-control to be driving your behavior. Things like slowing down your breath, which is the very first willpower skill that I teach people, is to slow down your breath, and not in a really forced way, in as gentle and patiently as you can. And slowing down the breath starts to shut down the fight or flight response. Exercise is another way to do it. So, for example, people who walk on a treadmill for 10 minutes are more focused, they're less tempted by cigarettes and chocolate. And so sometimes just getting up out of your chair and using your body a little bit will actually shift you away from the stress physiology into the physiology of self-control and self-awareness.
And it can be that simple.
Yeah.
That small.
You don't have to fix the problem. I mean, it's great if there are problems you can fix, but I think it's so important to know that life is basically defined by a series of challenges,
right.
and it's kind of a mistake to think I'm going to get to a point where life's not going to be that stressful. So we need these strategies so that our response to stress is a little bit healthier. And it's amazing how the stress physiology can actually completely change how you respond to decisions you need to make. One study showed that if you give rodents a drug that blocks the effect of stress hormones, you cannot create addiction. That literally the only way to turn rats into addicts, which actually is not hard to do normally, is they have to be able to have a stress response, because it's the stress that ends up driving them back to drink the alcohol or self-administer cocaine, all the terrible things that they're doing to rats in these studies. But in many ways, we're the same way. It's the stress that allows us to become addicted. It's the stress that makes us procrastinate. If you can alter the physiology of it so that you are having more of a healthy challenge response, it's a completely different way of relating to challenges.
You know, saying, oh, I'm either going to reach for a glass of wine or I'm going to take a walk first and then assess, do I really want a glass of wine or is it more of a coping mechanism?
And that's why you've heard so many speakers at this conference who are in positions of leadership, you've heard them say that they need a meditation practice or they need an exercise practice or a yoga practice.
Right.
And that is not a coincidence. I mean, these people who are in the most high-pressure positions with the biggest demands, they are prioritizing things that influence the physiology of stress above and beyond a lot of other things in their lives. They're meditating, they're practicing yoga, they're exercising. And these are very important ways to sustain ourselves.
Thanks for bringing it back to that level, because a lot of people think, oh, well, I don't have time for that. And so, actually, you can't afford to not make time for that.
Yeah, that is exactly right. But the more you don't do it, the more you're going to believe you don't have time. Because you're going to be in that mindset of immediate survival. And because you can't, you know, there's, you may not know that there's going to be any sort of payoff from exercising or meditating,
right.
But you might think, I need to stare at my computer screen and answer 3 more emails, and then I'll feel some relief. It's hard to see the big picture when you're stuck in that survival mode.
So, final question, bouncing off of that, coming to your personal productivity types of habits, how do you structure your day to both get things done but also to stay sane and hopefully sustainable?
I gotta tell you, one of the best pieces of advice I ever got was when I was writing my dissertation, and some dissertation expert came into Stanford and gave us a workshop to help us survive. And there were 2 things she said. One was, you have to decide how much time you can commit on a daily basis to this project in a realistic way, and trust that you will come to a timely conclusion if you invest that much time in it. And there's something about committing, I'm going to do 10 minutes a day, or an hour a day, or 10 hours a day, and to make a real commitment that in that amount of time, you will get it done. And it, for whatever reason, knowing that there's a limit to what you can do, and that it also has to be sufficient to get it done, it shapes every decision you make in a project so that you do get things done, and it is with the degree of precision and perfection that is realistic, that can be done. And that takes care of a whole lot of procrastination. And the other thing that she said was to work in units of 45-minute hours, and that for 15 minutes every hour, you have to do something that nourishes your soul or something like that, is what she said. And I remember some engineer raised his hand and was like, how do you know what nourishes your soul? How do you know what you enjoy? And she was kind of like, whoa.
It's been too long there, buddy.
This is the culture. So I actually think about that now. I work in 45-minute units.
Okay.
And the other 15 minutes of the hour, I have to do something else that is just for me.
Which is also part of the changing the physiology of stress.
And also what feels like doing something for me is still part of work. That maybe I'm working on finishing a chapter and it feels very sort of tight and focused. And then that 15 minutes is going to be, I'm just going to brainstorm the next class I want to teach. And it feels very free. Mm. And so it's technically I'm still working, but it is a shift in the focus or the skill that I'm using so that it feels refreshing. And then also to keep my sanity, I exercise several times a day and practice and meditation practice. And I split it up over the day. If I get to the afternoon and I haven't practiced and I haven't exercised yet, it just does not work. And so I've learned I have to get up early enough to make sure I can do that. And I need to replenish myself with it again. Otherwise, I'll end up, working late at night in a mindset that's not helpful. So I need to make sure that I exercise and practice again in the early evening so that I sort of reset back to a creative and centered self, instead of the sort of how I would otherwise end up at the end of the day, frazzled and,
Right. Any final words on everything that we've just talked about that you'd like to finish up with?
I mean, I'm curious. So you heard the first day of talks here, right? I'd love to hear what you were taking away from this event. If there's anything you heard that was really kind of exciting.
Well, one thing I've been struck with is what you had mentioned as far as pretty much everybody having a practice and just really understanding how integral that is. The other part that both you touched on a little bit in our talk today and that Eckhart Tolle also talked about in my interview with Tammy Simon yesterday, she talked about it also, which is that place of spaciousness.
Oh, space, yes.
Yeah, and actually I wanted to get to that in our talk. I'm just concerned about time here.
Yes, well, there's nothing you need to say except space.
Space.
I mean, that says it all. We spend so much time feeling constricted.
Yes.
Like there isn't enough room for the experience we're having, and we have to fight our way out of the experience we're having. And that has been something I've noticed too. How it's wonderful how many people are using the word space to describe freedom from suffering and creative opportunity.
Both freedom from suffering, but I really liked what you said about it yesterday, which seems like it turned it into a useful tool. You were talking about it in terms of anxiety, and I was transferring that to fear. Again, for the self-employed person who's like, oh my God, I'm going to go do this. I've never done it before. And what I heard was allowing myself the spaciousness to include that fear and that concern and to acknowledge it, but to allow for so much more space that it can be there.
Yes.
And I can continue to act.
And the opposite can be there too, to discover that even when fear is present, probably excitement is present too.
Right.
Probably courage is present there. But when we feel the fear, we tend to focus so laser tight on it,
yeah.
We can't even see our own courage. And that's part of what it means to have space, is that you don't have to fix or get rid of the fear, because you can turn your attention to everything that is also present at the same time.
Yeah, nice. And that's just so practical.
Yeah.
So in the course that you do, is that one of the do you turn that into an exercise and do that with people?
Yeah, in both the compassion class and in the willpower class. The ability to accept inner experiences and then make value-driven choices is a key strategy. And we do writing exercises and sort of life experiments. That idea that you're going to have inner experiences that seem to conflict with your goals, and that's not a problem. And we waste so much time thinking we're not allowed to have certain thoughts, we're not allowed to have certain emotions, we're not allowed to be afraid. And then we spend way too much energy trying to control things that are very difficult to control.
Right.
Yeah. So there are lots of ways to point yourself back at your goals and your values. But it's often these practices of meditation or yoga or exercise in a mindful way or in kind of an expansive environment, like going for a run outdoors.
Right.
That helps us connect to the part of us that's going to be able to make those value-driven choices.
Oh, excellent. So are those classes only in person at this point?
Right now, although I'm going to be offering a class through Sounds True in September that anyone can take. It's called, I don't know what we're calling it. It's something, there's going to be compassion in the title.
Okay.
And it's going to be something like a compassion-based approach to change.
Ooh.
So that's something where we'll bring in a little bit of the neuroscience and a lot of the practice.
Okay, so how can people connect with that? If that isn't quite set up yet, able to be signed up for?
You know, people can check in with my website anytime, or I'm on Twitter at Kelly McGonigal, and I'm always announcing next opportunities. We also do hope to have the Stanford Compassion Training available online or through distance education, probably in another year, though. We're not quite there yet.
Okay, yeah, that's a big project. Wow. Okay, so I'll put Twitter and your website and all that in the show notes so people can hook up with you. But that sounds like an awesome course.
Yeah.
I'm looking forward to it.
Yeah.
I'll be there.
Yay!
Right on.
I'll be there too.
Great. Well, thanks so much for talking, and awesome information and applicable in so many different ways. And everyone. It affects everybody. So thanks so much for what you do and for taking the time to talk with me. Links for this episode can be found on the website. Go to naturalprofessional.com/show notes. All one word, show notes. If you like what you hear in this podcast, one of the kindest ways you can show your appreciation is by leaving a review and a rating on the podcast page in iTunes. This is Sean Tuttle signing off with the reminder that the era of struggle is over.